Good morning, members. I'm going to call this meeting of the House State Government Finance and Election Committee to order for March 2nd, 2021. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. I'll ask the committee administrator, or excuse me, the committee legislative assistant to call the roll.
Chair Nelson?
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Present.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleavorn?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Present.
Representative Mason? Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, present.
Representative Quam?
Present.
And Representative New Brindley is excused. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Spreck. Next, we have the approval of the minutes for February 26th. Representative Cleavorn, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move that they be adopted as written.
Representative Cleavorn moves approval of the minutes from February 26th, 2021. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes have been approved. Members, we have a big agenda here today, so hopefully we can get through these bills. We got two this morning, and then we're going to be coming back after recess this evening to do Representative Richardson's bill. So I will move that House File 1019 be referred to taxes. And Representative Marquardt, Chair Marquardt, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I mean, one of the main goals of the Taxes Committee this year is to provide more accountability and transparency to taxpayers. And so what House File 1019 does is sets up a process to bring tax expenditures into the budget process. So what is a tax expenditure? It's kind of spending in the tax code, if you want. So if you just wanted to raise revenue in the tax committee, you would just have a broad base and you'd set a rate. But if you want to encourage home ownership, you do a mortgage interest deduction. If you want to make it easier for people to have child care, you have a child care credit. We exempt sales taxes off of clothing for competitive reasons. So it's those type of things. And it's no small amount. There's about 312 total tax expenditures. And if you add them all up, it comes to about $15.5 billion a year. And once it gets into the tax code, there is no line item in the budget. There is no regular review process. Many of these go on autopilot and just increase over time. And so what this would do is establish a tax expenditure review commission that would be composed of 9 members, 4 members of the Senate, actual members, 2 from majority, 2 from minority, 4 members of the House, 2 majority, 2 minority, and then a designee of the Department of Revenue. It would be staffed by the Legislative Budget Office they would say would take about 6 staff. They would provide the professional staffing, and then there would be also work through the Department of Revenue that would help provide some data for this. What the commission would do is initially in the first 3 years would look at all 312 tax expenditures and basically set up a purpose statement and how we could measure it. And then after that, they would look at all or most, and not all of them would come under it if it, you know, isn't a huge cost or if it's tied to the federal laws and so forth. But over 10 years, then they would look at them on a rotating basis, and they would provide recommendations that would go to the tax committees of the Senate and House, and then the Senate House Tax Committee would have to have a public hearing. So unlike some of the other tax expenditure bills that have come through, while this Tax Expenditure Review Commission could offer recommendations, it doesn't set up, okay, here's 10 tax expenditures, and unless the legislature acts, they go away. That is not in the bill, and that's been in some past ones. This would only make recommendations, and the legislature would have to go from there. So, members, the cost is about, well, I think $950 million, because just 1 year in the first year, and then $1.84 million. Basically, it's about $950,000 a year of costs for staff of the Legislative Budget Office and the Department of Revenue, and then operational costs. And then I think there's about $8,000 in costs that would go to members for travel and so forth. So members, it also changes timing on a couple reports. And then one last thing is that any new tax expenditure would have to have an expiration date of 8 years attached to it. So it would, you know, come back for review and so forth. So members, that is the bill, and I will take questions.
And Representative Marquardt, I got a couple of questions here, but from people, but I got one first. The cost in this bill is going to be carried not by our committee, but by the tax committee. Just want to make that up, make sure that's on the record.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that would be carried by the Tax Committee. I'm sorry I didn't mention that.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Nash, you had the first question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, I like the idea of shining a light on expenditures in the tax code. But I guess my one reservation is that it is just a suggestion or hey, we should look at this. I would love if we could bolt in a Sunset Commission-like effort with this, because while you say that provisions would have to sunset after 8 years, I guess I would like to know a little bit more about that, but I'm concerned that it would be an expense that would get incurred by the state, but it would only result in strong and friendly recommendations to our colleagues who could then, as they so often do, soundly ignore them and move on their own merry way. And I'm just wondering, what have you accounted for, and how have you provisioned this in such a way that it's not going to be a, gosh, guys, we should get rid of this expenditure, and then they all shake their head at you and pat you on the head and walk out of the room?
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, that's a great question. And you know, in the past, sometimes they've done that, where they've actually put a certain number out. This has been proposals. And then kind of like the base closure, if you don't do anything, they automatically eliminate themselves. And also only the new, just for clarification, only the new tax expenditures coming forward would have an expiration date of 8 years. All these other ones that would be reviewed that are existing would be, as you mentioned, a review. But while this doesn't go that far, this bill, this I think takes a real major step in the right direction, is that right now it's not part of the budget process at all. Nothing is happening to bring these 312 tax expenditures to light. This will at least provide a thorough in-depth. I mean, when you look at some of the things that will be looked at, you know, tax incidents, what if you eliminated that? What would be a revenue neutral, you know, tax rate that you could lower things to, looking at purposes? So it looks at the efficiencies of these tax expenditures. So I think what it would do, Representative Nash, is give the legislature some really good information that they could look at to then base some decisions. And until we kind of even start doing that, there never will be, you know, a potential review where they look at back and forth. But I just, in this bill, I didn't want to go to the point where we put them out there and the legislature has to take a positive vote. I mean, we know some years we don't even get a tax bill. So what if there's a number of them there and we don't even get a tax bill that we can agree on? So I certainly see what you're saying, but I think this is a good first step and really putting this out in the light.
Representative Nash, follow up.
Yeah, just very briefly. Well, Representative Marquardt, I, again, appreciate the the idea, but as somebody who has tried a number of times to remove provisions and only once successfully, it's rather Herculean, and I would love to see a bill that, one, doesn't cost as much, but two, actually puts some teeth into the removal of these things that are beyond a friendly suggestion. Again, appreciate the idea of letting taxpayers and legislators know what's being spent in the tax code, but I just think that it comes up a little short in the delivery. It's heavy on message and short on delivery, I guess, and I would love to see it higher on the delivery scale, because I think putting a sunset on some of these things would be very respectful to the taxpayer's wallet. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Marquardt. And just, I think, to follow up a bit where you started, what I heard you say was we're currently, and as someone who's new to the legislature, we're currently spending billions on tax expenditures. And can you talk a little bit about what our current process is to evaluate, like how would we currently in the legislature evaluate whether that's a good investment or not, how it impacts our overall tax burden on Minnesotans if we were to eliminate some of those tax expenditures.
Chair Marquardt.
Chair, Representative Greenman, probably the best way, I mean, there is every 2 years, the Department of Revenue puts out a tax expenditure budget where it lists the tax expenditure, gives information on it, and then also what the cost would be. So that's about it. Otherwise, it has to take initiative of a legislator to bring something forward. And one thing is that this commission will have legislators on it. 8 of the 9 are legislators. So if they agree on a bipartisan manner that, let's say this, you know, we recommend that this cease to exist, if you've got a bipartisan of those legislators, that would carry a lot of weight, I think, into the legislature. It's not just a review board of non-legislators. It's actually legislators who would, on a bipartisan basis, be recommending something. So, but other than that, right now, there just isn't, unless an individual member kind of brings one up specifically for expiration or extension.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, can you give me a sense of why this is important, how tax expenditures impact the overall sort of tax burden on Minnesotans?
Representative Chair Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman. Every time you carve out a specific tax expenditure, you're raising tax rates on others or lessening capacity to spend in other areas. So, I mean, the more you would eliminate these, if you wanted to make it revenue neutral, you would be able to lower rates. And in fact, the Department of Revenue gave a few examples of that in their report this year, that if you were to just even exempt some of those, that would be administratively easy to do. And, you know, you could lower rates. So, right, anytime you carve something out for someone else, the others are paying more or getting less.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really, since Representative Greenman asked the question I was most concerned about, this will be more of a comment. I just want to thank you, Chair Marquardt, for elevating this conversation. It is important to my Plymouth community, so I thank you for that. I appreciate always your commitment to fairness and transparency in the tax code and the work that you do with the Capitol. And to Representative Nash, I agree with many of the comments that he made that we need to find a way to really have teeth and making sure that we can work together to make sure that the dollars we're spending in our state through the tax code are really creating the ripple and effect and benefit that serves our state well. So I would invite Representative Nash to work with me and you and to see what we can do in the next year to improve our tax code. But really, thank you for your work for fairness and transparency.
Thank you.
Representative Marquardt, you want to So that was my last question, or do you want to wrap up and then we'll proceed to a vote?
Yep. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think anytime you can bring more accountability and transparency into the tax code, the better we are. I would appreciate your support.
And with that, members, I'll renew my motion that would refer House File 1019 to the Committee on Taxes. The legislative assistant will take the roll. You're muted, Sydney. There we go.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason? You're muted, Representative Mason.
Got it. Aye.
Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
With a vote of 11 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails.
And with that, Representative Markwart, you're back to your own committee. I hear that's a hard chair over there.
That's right. Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Have a good day.
The next bill on our agenda, and members, this is House File 7 and Representative Olson, and I will move that House File 7 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And members, just before we get started here, we will vote on this bill before we end our meeting this morning. And so members, keep that in mind as we go through our questioning. And I know there'll be lots of questioning and testimony. Representative Olson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I have to say it's good to be back in state government finance land. I missed the committee this year, so good to see all of you here. So thank you for hearing House File 7. House File 7 believes that Minnesotans care for one another, and we want a Minnesota to be a caring state where all our families can be healthy and safe. So I'm carrying this bill because everyone gets sick, and the coronavirus outbreak is another stark reminder that when people get sick, they should be able to stay home, not just for their own health or that of a loved one, but for the health of all of us. This bill would ensure that Minnesota is a state where, regardless of the color of your skin, your income, or where you work, you could afford to take the time to recover from an illness at home where you can limit its spread, where a sick kid can have the comfort of their parent caring for them, where you can go to the doctor before your illness goes from bad to worse, where you can seek support in the wake of sexual assault, and where those things don't mean you need to worry about missing bills or losing your job. Unfortunately, for far too many, especially those we've called essential workers during this pandemic, this isn't the Minnesota they experience. An estimated 36% of working people don't have any paid sick and safe time. This means that in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, more than a third of working people in our state face a terrible choice between caring for themselves or their loved ones and the loss of wages or employment, because in many circumstances, it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to care for themselves or a loved one. When it comes to state employees, a much higher percentage of workers already have earned sick and safe time that meets most of all of the requirements of the bill, with the possible exception of some weather-related uses. And as with the private sector, part-time, intermittent, and temporary employees are those least likely to have the protection of earned sick and safe time. In most cases, the fiscal note observes that the cost In this case in particular, and why we're here in state government finance, the fiscal note observes that the costs are so diffuse and long-term, making them negligible enough not to be considered in this fiscal note or in this bill. The only instance in which MMB even attempted to compute these enterprise costs is in the specific case of the replacement staffing at the 24/7 operations for those few employees who would have new benefits, and in keeping with our practice, these enterprise costs are not included in the bill before you. This is also keeping in what we have seen in more than a dozen states and numerous localities across the country where very similar proposals have been passed, including my own city of Duluth, plus Minneapolis and St. Paul. Providing earned sick and safe time also brings benefits to employers through improved recruitment and retention, lower employer health care costs through better use of preventive care, and lower presenteeism or coming to work sick. All of this, which means higher productivity, fewer workplace injuries, and a healthier workforce and state. Ultimately, House File 7 is about becoming the kind of caring state that I think we all want Minnesota to be. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take questions.
And I have listed one testifier, Kimberly Lewis, from the Minnesota School Boards Association. Ms. Lewis, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Kimberly Lewis, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent 333 school boards across Minnesota. And as well as this morning, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. We appreciate the opportunity to share some initial thoughts on House File 7. We have not had the opportunity to meet directly with Representative Olson. We hope to do so, and we look forward to learning more about this bill and working together. Our board's administration, particularly our school district business officials and human resource representatives, have some questions and concerns as it relates to the implementation and management of this proposal. As with last year's bill, our school district business officials and HR reps have alerted us to three main areas or with concerns or questions. Our primary concern is the cost to schools. School boards do not have the authority to levy for the funds that would be needed to cover the employer cost portion of this proposal. The funds would need to come out of the general fund, in other words, out of the classroom. In a district, an average district where there are 400 part-time employees, and I used my own school district as a reference for this example, they have 400 part-time employees on a staff of 1,900. That could mean up to $200,000 or more, plus the cost of substitutes. That could fund several teachers. It could lower class size. There's also the sought cost of administration and reporting of the program at the district level. At a time when most schools in Minnesota are experiencing budget deficits and making cuts, especially in the midst of this pandemic, how are schools to pay the cost? We don't generate revenue. We don't have widgets we sell, so it would come out of the general fund. Another question is how collective bargaining would be impacted. Representative Olson indicated that Duluth and Minneapolis and St. Paul have bargained for this. If passed, would this be a statewide benefit that would be part of the local bargaining negotiations? Would it supersede negotiations or both? And finally, due to the nature of the workforce within our schools, there may be a potential for a greater need for the number of substitutes. And it is already extremely burdensome to find subs for our paraprofessionals, education assistants, and other part-time positions. It's our responsibility to keep the continuity in the classroom, the cafeteria, the bus, the playgrounds, et cetera. So we plan, or we hope to continue discussions with both our district personnel and Representative Olson, and we appreciate the committee's time today and listening to our concerns. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. I also have on here listed, it said if needed, I'm assuming that's for question to answer questions, Christian Bateson, Deputy Commissioner of MMB, and Nicole Lissenbach, the Deputy Commissioner of DALI. I guess do either one of those need to testify or do you there to answer questions?
Mr. Chair, they're there to answer questions.
Thank you. That's what I assume. With that, I've got a list of questioners starting here. Representative Nash, you had your hand up and you took it down. Do you want to ask questions now or do you want to at the end or how do you want to work that?
I will ask one brief question now and then come back with a follow-up. And I wanted to ask the last testifier what the number that she had again for her school district was and explain sort of how that would work for the occasional substitute teacher and what if that's part of the cost that she projected for her school district.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I did back of the envelope math. The district that I was referring to has 1,900 full-time employees. 400 of those employees are part-time positions. So I just took the 400 positions, multiplied that by the maximum of 48, and then an average salary of $10 per hour, and came up with just under $200,000.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you. And that's one of my many, many concerns on this is in talking previously to the school district that I represent, that this is an area of concern for them. And as you pointed out, there is no mechanism, and I believe you said you don't have widgets that you sell, and that's a very good comparison, that there's no way for you to make this revenue up other than to take it out of the general fund, which then comes out of the levy at the end of each year. I know that cities have some very similar concerns, and I recognize the problems that this creates for not just public employers, but lots and lots of Main Street businesses are dependent on part-time work, both seasonal and regular work, and this is a massive problem. And I'm hopeful that we do not pass this bill. I don't believe that it is something that is in need of being passed the way you've got it written, Representative Olson. I certainly understand the compassion around it. I know you are a very compassionate person, but this is unbelievably damaging for all different striations of employers, and it's a huge problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will ask some more questions later.
Representative Claiborne, you're next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. I think first, because I work closely with Ms. Lewis on issues that are important to our suburban school districts. And I think as I listened to her question and wrote down the three points that she's representing today, I understand the validity of these questions, and I'm committed to no unfunded mandates for our school districts. I do believe that the concerns that you have are issues that can be addressed with full adequate funding for our school districts. And it's something that I have been a strong proponent of, as you well know, we've sat in many meetings together. I think it is, as a legislative body, I think it's very unfair for us to ask people who are being paid $10 an hour to carry the burden of the underfunding of our school districts. That's what I will say about the comments that I heard from you. And I would work very carefully and closely with you to address the needs of our district and to make sure that the funding is there so that those who are least compensated in our districts do not carry an undue burden, and to make sure that we have the funding in place so that every district all across our state would have the adequate funding they need to recruit and retain the part-time employees and substitutes that we need. This is a larger problem than how do we pay for people who need time off when they are ill. We certainly do not want ill substitutes in our classroom, and we certainly do not want people who are distracted by illness of a family member to be there when they really need to be someplace else. So, Ms. Lewis, my commitment to you is that I will work with you however I can to make sure that we do not have unfunded mandates for our districts. And then, Representative Olson, this leads to the question that I wanted to ask you about the bill that's before us today. It's well known at this point in the recovery of COVID that the recovery has been very much K-shaped. And we've had very strong recovery for people who are at the top and really hard times for those who are at the lower economic brackets in our society. Many of us in my district can take the sick time that we need when our families require it or we personally need it. But for those in the lower income brackets, many of them cannot. Could you please talk about how your bill will serve so many people in our state who are in those lower economic brackets? Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Claiborne. I think in the spirit of your comments and question, you're exactly right that the people that probably need this benefit the most, and especially during COVID, we have shown that don't have it in our state. So, you know, the objective here is clear: to get people who don't have earned sick and safe time, earned sick and safe time. And that does mean, you know, to the point of the testifier, some of our lowest paid part-time workers in our school districts too. And, you know, to that point too, if we're talking about part-time employees, I'll just mention too, in the bill, it'll be accruing at a slower rate if you're a part-time employer. So in terms of some of the costs Ms. Lewis mentioned for part-time employers and just the overall cost of this benefit, it's, you know, 0.75%, according to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics surveys of employers. So the cost to employers themselves isn't huge, but the benefit to those people, Representative Cleavorn, you're mentioning, is huge. It might mean be able to go get your vaccination and not have to lose a paycheck to do that. It might mean, you know, taking care of someone who's sick with COVID, who you currently can. You know, it's for those lowest, essentially, it's low-wage workers that don't have this benefit, that really struggle to get by. And it's women, it's people of color, it's people in rural areas. And this bill is really geared towards making sure everybody in our state has earned sick and safe time. So thank you for the question, Representative Cleavorn.
Representative Cleavorn, and follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Next, I have Representative Koznick. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, the sick and safe benefits that you're referring to, are there currently some examples of companies that provide this that you're aware of in Minnesota?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Koznick. Yes, there are employers that have this currently by their own accord. There's also, as mentioned in my testimony, we have city ordinances that have passed in three different cities that also require it for all employers. So there are examples, and the scope of this bill, obviously, and you know, Representative Koznick is aware, we're here because of the MMB portion and the state government employees piece of this. But in the testimony we heard in other committees, we had a number of them from across the state testify about earned sick and safe time.
Representative Koznick, follow up.
Thank you. Well, I think regardless of the jurisdiction of this committee, which sometimes frustrates me that our election certificates aren't good enough to talk about the bill in general, but I will go ahead and just state it. Currently, if it's such a great deal for businesses and their employees, they are permitted to provide any benefit that they want. And additionally, there's probably additional private market insurance coverages to provide for this. And if businesses want to offer that to their employees, or their employees want that additional coverage, they can negotiate that through, and we're not permitted from doing that at this point. So thank you for the bill. I'll be voting no.
With that, thank you, Representative Koznick. Representative Bonner is the next on my list.
Thank you. I have actually two questions. First, I know that we've had very fascinating studies about similar benefits that have been employed. What was surprising about them is that it was a really mixed bag about folks who actually used them. In fact, the folks who needed them used them. But often what was really surprising is that they didn't get used nearly as much as was expected, or at least thought. But what they noticed was that there was an incredible amount of retention with employees just by merely having the option. I guess my question is this, the first question is, earned safe and sick time is something that is earned over time. I think you mentioned that, you know, as a part-time worker, you would accrue it more slowly as a full-time worker. And I think really what we're saying is that this is essentially tied to the work that people are doing while on the job. And can you explain maybe a little bit more about how that works or what that would look like for people over time?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner. Yeah, so in the bill, if you have the bill, it would be, we have Section 3 on page 3, Article 1, Section 3 talks about the accrual rate. So it would be 1 hour of earned sick and safe time for every 30 hours worked, up to a maximum of 48 hours of earned sick and safe time in a year. And then the bill describes usage and accrual and things. So this is really a place where workers really see this as an insurance against illness, like that they have this benefit there. It's not something that gets taken advantage of. And again, we heard that testimony time and time again in other committees. And so it's an opportunity to work towards having this benefit. To your point, they're earning these as they're working and they're using it. And we're finding, to your point, there's more folks who are seeing it as an insurance policy in case they get sick rather than taking advantage of it for reasons that people had once feared. But it's not showing that to be the truth, as you mentioned.
And Representative Bonner, a follow-up and to that.
Thank you. So thank you for that, by the way. I really appreciate that. And I know that one of the other benefits of this particularly is that, you know, you have a lot of lower wage workers, particularly women, who end up driven out of the marketplace. And of course, we know employee retention's an issue, and it's more costly to have to hire new employees than to keep good ones. So I really appreciate that. I know that you mentioned earlier that we have implemented this in other cities. And so I'm just curious about, you know, from an objective perspective, those cities that have actually employed this, if you could talk a little bit more about what has happened in those cities and what benefits they may have reaped or how it's worked out for them.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner. Yeah, so as I've mentioned in my testimony, my own city has earned sick and safe time, and they actually have it as one of their legislative priorities to have it passed at a state level. The city council voted unanimously in favor, so we're seeing it as a benefit to our city and to our workers, and it's not something our city or any of the cities that have implemented it are talking about walking back or repealing. So it's going well in terms of workers having the benefit they need. To take care of their loved ones, to take care of themselves. So, and we're seeing it as a benefit to our economy. And I think especially, again, during this pandemic time, to have already had this for our workers and those protections. So it's going well. And we had in the last committee, again, which everyone could have heard some of that testimony, we had a city councilor member from Duluth and one from St. Paul testifying about both the implementation and the successes of their ordinances.
Representative Elkins is the next person on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, Representative Olson, in my private sector career, I had employers who had personal time off policies where sick time and vacation time, you know, went into one pool. One of the things that I observed is that people would come in sick in order to avoid eating into their vacation time. Is this an issue that that you've explored in developing this bill?
Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins. Yeah, the goal of this, as I mentioned, is really to keep people from going to work sick. So to your point exactly, that's exactly what we're trying to do is make sure people feel like they can stay home when they're sick. And that's exactly the goal of this. So, yes, you're correct.
Thank you.
Representative, the next on my list is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson. I just wanted to sort of bring into this committee, we, in workforce and business development, we heard the testimony of many, many workers who didn't have the benefit of this, mostly at the bottom of the income spectrum, telling really tough stories about the choices that they were making when they got sick, between going in to work sick, between missing a paycheck that they couldn't afford. Folks are living paycheck to paycheck. And also about parents who had to make really tough decisions. I think we heard one who lost her job over having to take time to care with her sick kid. And I think in this moment of a pandemic where that is in everybody's life, not having this is a really, really hard thing for workers. And as I think Representative Olson started with, the workers at the bottom of the income spectrum, the ones with the least amount of power to be able to get this just as individuals on their own. One of the things I just wanted to ask you is, you know, I don't think that you should have to live in Duluth or St. Paul or Minneapolis in order to be able to earn sick time, to be able to have that benefit. Can you talk about the benefits of doing this statewide?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. I think you highlight a really good point that we often hear the call for not wanting to do patchwork policies like this, that we want to have a uniform policy across the state that makes it easier for employers to implement, makes things more competitive, and ensures that workers, no matter where they live, have access to the benefit. Especially, like I mentioned, too, this impacts every corner of the state. This isn't just an urban issue. This is all areas, and in particular, some rural communities where people, workers live, you know, taking care of other people, taking care of vulnerable people, working in our schools, working in, you know, our nursing homes, other places too. So this is an issue across our state, and having the ability to have that uniformity, I think, is a really good thing to ensure that we are both considering the employers with how they're implementing this, but really we're hitting workers all over our state.
Representative Greenman, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson. I'm really grateful that you brought this bill. It is long overdue. This is something that workers need. And I think in this moment, in this pandemic, where we've really seen both the public health benefits of and the public health urgency of people staying home when they're sick, it's also really important to the workers that have been most impacted by this pandemic. So I just really appreciate it, and I'm proud to support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next person on my list is Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Again, just a quick, I know with the order of speakers, I just wanted to make a quick comment. One of the previous questions was with regards to the bill being a mandate. And just to remind everybody that this bill is a floor and not a ceiling. If employers want to go beyond what the bill requires, have at it. This just sets a baseline floor for requiring for this. So know that if employers want to do more, and many do, that is allowed within the bill. And I guess that's to the bill author, to Representative Olson, that's a true statement, right? This just sets a floor as opposed to a ceiling?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. Absolutely. You said it perfectly, and I hadn't said it yet in this committee hearing, but that usually comes up, and you're exactly right.
Okay. Representative Nash, you're the next person on my list.
Mr. Chair, I'll wait till the end.
I've only got one other person, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, Representative Olson, if you answered this question already. I was distracted by a text from my constituent where this question is coming from. Can you please explain the difference between earned safe and sick time and paid family medical leave? There is confusion as to these two bills, and if you could just maybe give us a quick primer on the difference between this bill and the bill we'll hear later. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne. I mean, just briefly, what I'll say is these are very different bills. The paid family, I mean, the spirit is the same to take care of people, but this is a very short instance where people are taking, you know, a couple of hours, a couple of days off for an illness, for a visit, you know, to a doctor or whatnot, taking care of their kids. Where paid family and medical leave is more the extended benefit. So in terms of like how the worker would see it, that would be the difference in terms of the duration of it. And then I would also say that, you know, one of the things that this is a different way of looking at it in terms of, I'm just gonna pull up my notes too, just to make sure I get this right. That they meet different needs, as I mentioned, for the working families. You know, earned sick and safe time is the 48 hours of paid time care off for a year. Per year, but paid family leave provides 12 weeks per year of family leave and 12 weeks of medical leave. So that's kind of the distinguishable difference there. Earned sick and safe time covers the short term in terms of hours or days of paid time when you get the flu, like I mentioned. Paid family leave establishes a state-administered insurance program, so it covers longer-term life events that affect us all.
Excuse me, Representative Olson, can you slow down a minute while we may understand what you're
saying? Representative Claiborne,
Thank you. Okay. If you could just slow it down a little bit, because this is a constituent who's trying to understand, right? So thank you.
Yes,
Representative Olson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to seem like I was being duplicative in stating the very obvious things about my bill versus paid family leave, because I assume you may get the opportunity to hear that bill as well. But yes, so earned sick and safe time, and they're very different. They're setting out to meet different needs of working families. So earned sick and safe time allows workers to take care of themselves and their families through like day-to-day illnesses, emergencies, snow days, where paid family and medical leave provides for extended absence for major life events. And earned sick and safe time allows workers to accrue 48 hours of paid time to care per year. And paid family leave provides 12 weeks per year of family leave and 12 weeks of medical leave. Earned sick and safe time covers short-term care in the form of hours or days of paid time to care when we get the flu for a couple of days or need to take a loved one to the doctor. Paid family and medical leave establishes a state-administered insurance program. It covers longer-term life events that affect all of us at some point, like bonding with a new child or supporting a loved one at the end of their life. But both really ensure that working people have the time off that they need to care for people. And so I would see these two as complementary, that really as a state, to be the kind of state I believe Minnesotans are asking us to be, we really need to have both of these together to ensure families can take care of each other in whatever the situation that may be in front of them, whether it's short-term illness or long-term needing of something like a paid family and medical leave.
Thank you. Representative Nash, you're the last person on my list.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, there's a lot here. And again, Representative Olson, I appreciate your compassion. A couple questions around the morphology of the bill. Can you give me an idea of the duration that one must work again in order to become eligible for these? Because I wanted to make sure that I got that right before I go down a different line of questioning.
Representative Olson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes. So in terms of the accrual rating, you work a minimum of 1 hour of sick and safe time for every 30 hours worked, you get up to 48 hours. And there is a some standards of terms of like how long you must work and carry over and whatnot on page 3 and 4 of the bill. And you have to be, I'll pause there.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Olson, walk me through, so we heard from school districts who this would be very expensive for, but maybe walk me through how maybe up in your district or in my district or some of the others, how does this apply to, say, a family farm that might have the occasional hired help that they bring in, and how does that work from an administrative perspective? How does that work for a cost perspective? Maybe walk me through that, because I think that that's something that my constituents are going to want to know more about, and I'm sure that a lot of them around the state of Minnesota would like to know about as well.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. And I apologize, I didn't answer your question fully the first time. 90 days, I think, is what you're actually asking for, not the accrual rate, but how long you have to work before you can use the benefit. As for your second question, that's a good question. It was asked in another committee as well. So yeah, everyone gets sick and we want everyone to be able to take care of themselves. And we think it's prominent, you know, more prominent when it's a family member. And this bill applies to all employers and all workers who aren't sole proprietors or self-employed unless they work less than 80 hours per year in Minnesota. So it's really aimed to cover people who need it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Olson, I think you're missing my point. I'm trying to convey that many farms utilize what might be considered a hired hand that does occasional work that isn't a family member. And, you know, I don't need to remind you just how difficult it is to be a farmer in the state of Minnesota. And this is going to eat into an already very thin margin business. And I'm just trying to figure out, have you actually thought through that? I mean, I appreciate the desire. I appreciate your consideration, but you know, I have a lot of dairy farmers and crop farmers here in my district that do utilize hired help. This would kill them because they're already, you know, if they make, sometimes dairy farmers, if they break even, they're ecstatic. You know, lately dairy prices have been really tight. And I've had a lot of them close businesses because of regulations and costs, and they're tired of breaking even. Well, this is going to put them in a position where they're no longer even going to break even for accruing sick and safe time for people who are occasional workers. So please don't gloss over that. Give me your assessment of how this works for the family farmer.
Representative Olson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. Well, as I mentioned, you would need to work at least 80 hours per year in Minnesota to earn the benefit. So depending on, you know, what kind of situation you have there. The accrual rate, depending on how much they're working, you know, the 1 to 30 hours, you know, 1 hour for every 30 hours worked. If they're working more part-time, obviously it's gonna take longer to accrue. You know, and again, I think it's just maybe a fundamental difference we have, Representative Nash, that again, the spirit of the bill is to cover people who don't have the benefit. Because I think about those workers, wherever they are, they also deserve to be home with their families when they're sick. They also deserve to be able to take time off, you know, to go to a doctor's visit. It doesn't matter where you work. It doesn't matter, you know, what part of the state or what work. We all deserve that benefit. And I would say, you know, seasonal employees, if that's a piece of what you're talking about, we do take that into consideration, and they're largely excluded if they don't work for that 90 days, as I mentioned. So if you haven't had 90 days on the job, you're not earning the benefit. So we do as best we can try to take into account the exceptions around some of what you're talking about. But at the end of the day, we are really trying to cover as many people as possible.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let's switch gears because I want to ask this question, and we'll come back to the 90 days and the employee and the hired hand at a family farm. But so you, Representative Olson, had talked about there being, I think, three municipalities that have this currently in their cities. But if I remember correctly, your bill does not create a level playing field or a uniform assessment for everybody. There are some carve outs that you have. Could you walk through what those carve outs are?
Representative Olson.
Chair Nelson, Representative Nash, I don't believe what I would define as anything as a carve out in this bill. Again, we set a floor for what's needed. And if you have specific pieces you'd like me to talk about, you can certainly ask.
Representative Nash, another question, and then I've got somebody else who've raised their hand. So Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad we have plenty of time left because I'm an inquisitive guy. But Representative Olson, so you don't have statewide preemption in this bill for your floor, if I'm correct, and if I'm wrong, please do correct me. But is there preemption for the city that you live in, and Minneapolis and St. Paul? Do they have to abide by the construct of your bill, or do they have their own, perhaps lesser implementation of this?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. So yeah, we're setting the floor. So as long as, you know, most of the cities will have this standard already, we modeled this, you know, this legislation is largely modeled off of what we've seen in, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth. And so this is the floor, and if they need to make changes to keep up with this law, they would do that. But you know, anybody can go above and beyond, as Representative Carlson mentioned earlier, that this is really setting that floor.
Representative Carlson, and then if we get back to anyone else. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Just wanted to had to kind of quickly unmute myself there. Again, just kind of picking up on some of the conversation up until this point.
having been around for a while now, and this bill made great progress in the last biennium, having made it through four or five committees. I think it was even scheduled for a standalone floor vote. So it made great progress, and seeing a lot of, again, similarities in terms of the line of questioning from then that we're having now. But one of the major concerns at the time was the patchwork that that was concerned when cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth, and how employers would have to deal with a patchwork of regulation. This bill addresses that major concern that was coming from business groups. So Representative Olson, in terms of this addressing the patchwork and providing consistency throughout the state, in terms of other states that have implemented this, I think there's a dozen or so, any reaction from other states in terms of how this is playing out statewide in those areas?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, Representative Carlson, for the question. Yeah, again, what we have seen, all of the data shows that it's positive, that workers, you know, are able, the retention of workers is better, the workers not going to work sick, that people aren't abusing it. So we have a lot of data, you know, as we, again, to your point, this isn't new. This bill's been around for a long time. And so we've been able to continue work and modify and think about and see the data that comes out of other states and other cities. And to your point too, this, you're right. We're not trying to do a patchwork. That said, anybody could go above this bill. If we lay the foundation and we, but there may be cities that decide to do a more ambitious ordinance, and that's completely fine in this bill, but we at least want to make sure all workers have some coverage. And that's really what this bill sets out to. And again, every year that passes, we're seeing states getting further ahead of us in this. We're seeing cities take it to themselves to take this on, which I want us to get this bill across the finish line. And because of all of that data, we're better able to make a case of why Minnesota needs this as well.
Thank you, follow-up. Representative Carlson, follow-up, and then I now have more people on the list. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Mostly just a comment. I mean, Minnesota is a leader in many areas. Unfortunately, this is an area that we are not. But we have the benefit of learning from what other states are doing. So these what-if questions, I mean, there's data out there that we can point to of how they can be addressed, and quite frankly, have been addressed quite successfully. So again, not a leader in this area. I think it's well past time that we get on board with this and start helping our fellow Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for carrying this bill. It's a heavy lift. I'm hoping we can see this one get across the finish line this year.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Next on my list is Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize to the committee having a monitor problem, so I don't know what I can't get on there. So, I was wondering if the author, Representative Olson, could speak to the penalties contained in the bill for employers that may fall short of what's mandated in the bill. How would this bill be enforced?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kosnick. And the next stop is judiciary, which I imagine we'll have a robust discussion about it there. But we have touched on it. So, yes. So I probably could actually turn it over to, if Dolly is willing to speak a little bit, that actually falls more within their area to speak. We do change the penalties in here, and from bill author perspective, the goal here is to provide, you know, just assurance to workers and incentives. We don't want to, penalties is not the goal of this. We're trying to make sure that we have maximums. These aren't required. It gives Dolly some flexibility, but the goal is to really get businesses to provide the benefit, and the hope is not to do penalties, and that's why they're just, you know, maximums but not requirements. But I can let Dolly speak to that too.
Ms. Blissenbach, if you want to identify yourself for the record and attempt to answer the question.
Yes, and thank you, Chair, members of the committee, and I apologize. I just had to do a school drop-off, so I'm from my car. So there are two changes to penalties that are available to the Department of Labor and Industry. The first is an increase in the maximum penalty for failure to submit records that are requested by the department. And that essentially changes what is in current law for the failure to submit records from a maximum of 1,000 to a maximum of 10,000 per violation. This, as I and as Representative Olson said, this is a maximum. We do, when looking at penalties and calculations, we look at a number of different factors to determine the penalty that is issued. The second change in penalties has to do with our compliance order authority. We have the ability to, for repeat or willful violations of the statutes that we enforce at the Department of Labor and Industry, this increases the maximum civil penalty from 1,000 to 10,000 as well. Again, that is a maximum, not the required penalty that exists in the statute.
Thank you, Ms. Listenbach. Follow-up, Representative Kosnick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. That's quite interesting that you'd mentioned penalties and incentives. Just because of the nature that we have limited ability to debate these bills, I'm curious where the incentives, what the incentive parts are written into the statute that you're proposing. We talked about the benefits that I think the free market provides. If this is a benefit that an employer wants to provide to entice their best talent to come work for them, I think that's could be obvious. But I'm wondering what the incentives are in the bill that you have, because certainly the penalties are obnoxious. They're incredible. You've increased them tenfold. And I'm curious also what the penalties are in the Duluth bill. And overall, because I don't think I'll get a follow-up here, you know, what we're doing is taking the ideas of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth and spreading across the state in a metro-centric manner that I don't think fits for all Minnesotans. And the penalties are incredible in the bill, and I don't see any tax breaks or reductions for employers to actually incent them to provide this benefit, other than rightfully so the free market is what should be determining this.
Representative Kosnick, I've been a little freer today because we have time, because we knew this was going to be a bill that a lot of people had a lot of questions on, so we gave it more time today. And so, members, I've been a little more free on letting people ask them additional questions, because when I don't have people's hands up and their name on my list, I've been a little more free to let people ask more than one question. But if you want to ask another question, you can, put your hand back up and you get back on the list. So Representative Olson, if you want to answer the question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, Representative Kosnick. So I will note that the fiscal note, if you read it, it says that that only 2% of complaints result in any penalties, let alone the largest, you know, what we just discussed there. So it's not that. So, I mean, there's the reality of what's happening and what likely will happen. I will say that the incentives are really the lower presenteeism, more retention, and, you know, just the incentives of a healthier workforce, really, for our employers. And the incentives, too, are for workers to know that they will have this benefit and that their employer will offer, you know, work in good faith to ensure that they have the benefit. And so there are major incentives. The whole bill really is an incentive for a healthier Minnesota, and that's really what we're trying to do. And the penalties are just, they're not required. They're there to just make sure that we keep our workers safe and that they're getting this benefit. And employers can continue to go above and beyond for, you know, recruitment purposes and whatnot. So that's really what this bill's about.
Next person I've got here, Representative Quam hasn't asked a question yet. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Analyzing data from the well, we got a Federal Reserve, and they look at the regional. They also have information on cities. And I've noticed that Minnesota seems to be being hit harder with the low wage scale, plus Minneapolis is doing worse employment-wise than regional and national, you know, similar metro areas. Has there been any correlation of the city's policies impacting the actual employment of the, you know, the lower income and the people that would be maybe impacted by small businesses decreasing their employment? I mean, that aspect of the bill, you know, it every time we add benefits, we want to make sure we don't decrease the opportunity to have a job. And have you analyzed that impact when structuring this? Because you went down to, you know, the federal bill was at a high, what, 50 and above. You're going down to anyone that employs anyone. And that's probably why there's so many FTEs being added into the on the fiscal, the new fiscal note, just to keep track of all this data that's being generated. So just wondering if the author has looked at the secondary impact that this might have on the state as a whole.
And before we go to Representative Olson, Representative Quam, you mentioned a document that you were reading. If you have a chance, can you provide that to me, and so we can provide it to the committee so we can all see the data. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. So there have been studies across, you know, the nation in this regard, and there is no correlation between this benefit and the decrease in employment opportunities that you mentioned, or so maybe we're looking at the same information, and it's good. It's good news for the Earned Sick and Safe Time benefit and what it does for employers and employees.
Representative Quam, follow-up.
Just that I will forward to committee, and I think you also received the emails from the Cassati and the Federal Reserve, where they've got studies, and they do the regional, and they also have breakouts for some of the metro areas. And in the graphics, there were some troubling aspects about low-income employment. And so I was hoping the author had dug deeper into Minneapolis, since one of the major differences is that Minneapolis has its own special constraint upon employers that have what, more than the 80 hours a year of any employee would have to have this benefit, you know, that type of impact. I just always worry about the secondary impacts. The intent is great, but what are the effects? So that's why I brought it up, and I will again forward that email. I thought everybody had already gotten it.
Thank you, Representative Quam. The next person on my list, Representative Nash, you wanted to go last, or?
Yeah, I'll go last.
Okay, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate being allowed to ask a few different questions. Representative Olson, to the question about costs to employers, one of the questions I just received is, can you talk about the percentage, the actual percentage this is in the cost to an employer? My constituents are trying to figure this out. So could you talk about that?
And Representative Olson, before you answer, just, I know we've been going a little far afield from what our jurisdiction is, but we have seemed to have time this morning, and so I know we've been going into areas that normally aren't under our purview. But Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair and members, it is my pleasure to spend an ample amount of time with each of you answering all of your questions about this bill. I am glad to. So regarding the cost to employers, that according to the annual Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of employers, the average cost of providing paid sick and safe time to employers is only 0.75%, so 0.75% of total labor costs. Though the wage and benefit share of total costs varies by industry, even in the high labor industries like restaurants, labor costs are perhaps only 0.5% of total costs. So when considered as a portion of the overall cost, the percent resulting from paid sick and safe time is closer to 0.33%, so 0.33% at the high end.
Follow-up, Representative Claiborne, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just have a quick follow-up on that. The second part of that is they're asking, according to the studies that have been out there, and please forgive me for not having read all of these studies, what does this do? What is the impact on their overall health care costs going forward when this has been offered in these other states and in your communities that you've referenced earlier?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne. And I don't have every study or everything, but overall, the generalization is it's a healthier workforce. You know, in terms of people being able to stay home when they're sick, not spread illness, we all know with what we've seen with COVID, the boundaries of the illness doesn't, you know, in offices, across city boundaries, I mean, things spread. So staying home when you're sick, you know, keeps everybody healthy. So, you know, lower costs in terms of being able to treat things too before they get out of control. I remember a story from back when I, early days in Duluth working on this prior to coming to the legislature, a woman told me the story of getting behind on her well child visits. And then her kid got really sick. And so it's also like the proactive way we keep our workforce healthy. So, and so it's the increased use of preventative care as much as it is staying home when you're sick too, which helps keep our workforce healthier, which lowers healthcare costs.
And Representative Olson, I think anecdotally they're saying that just this year the flu, partly because of the masks and partly because people are being forced to stay home, we haven't had as large of a flu outbreak this year as we had in previous years. So anecdotally, there's some evidence there. Next person on my list is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for this robust discussion on this bill. I just want to sort of reorient, I think, something that was said earlier, which is I don't think our job here at the legislature is to sort of figure out what business will do on their own. I think our job is to focus on what Minnesotans want and need, what they need for their families, what they need for themselves when they get sick, and also what our public health needs, what we all need together. And I think, again, this pandemic could not have been a better and more important example of the public health needs of this in addition to how it impacts families. I do think it would be helpful to just hear, and I think you may have said in the beginning, but just so that we are talking, what we're talking about this policy, what specifically would this policy allow workers to be able to earn time to take off for? Like, what are we talking about in their daily lives that they can use it for?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. Yeah, so I think we've touched on it folks are in the bill, we lay out specifically what you can use your earned sick and safe time for, but it's being able to take care of yourself or a loved one when you're sick or ill. It's able to access preventative care, as we've discussed. You're able to, for those fleeing, you know, sexual assault, domestic violence, you're able to take care of yourself in those situations, whether it's meeting with an advocate or an attorney, that you're able to take care of those. You're able to, you know, take your grandmother to go get her COVID vaccine. You know, it's be able to care for yourself, your immediate loved ones during times of illness, but also keep yourself healthy. And then the safe time piece is really important as well, as we know that is something that people need access to. And so we have that written into the bill as well.
Follow-up, Representative Greenman. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Olson. Those sound like things to me that workers across the state of Minnesota, not just in my district of Minneapolis and Eastern Richfield, but across the state of Minnesota doing all sorts of work need. And it to me, it just seems like common sense. And so, again, I really hope that we in the legislature, that we are really thinking about what Minnesotans want and need, not just sort of what business will do on their largesse. We need to ensure that our workers, our small businesses, and all Minnesotans are healthy and thriving. And so, again, really appreciate this discussion. Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. You know, I think, again, we brought this forward again, but we talk a lot about, you know, here at the legislature that our purpose and our mission is really to serve the people of our state. And we've seen with COVID the really large disproportionate impact that this has had, on particularly on women in the workforce. We've seen women exiting the workforce in large numbers recently to care for children, sick loved ones, care for themselves, that kind of thing. I do have a question, I promise, but I wanted to illustrate an example because I think it's a perfect example of really kind of what I think a lot of employers are going to face and a lot of employees. I have a girlfriend who was laid off, unfortunately, just at the beginning of the pandemic. Hard worker. She worked for the same company for almost 15 years, worked overtime, worked every weekend, did everything she could to make ends meet, didn't make the greatest salary, but she always did everything she had to do. And in waiting to look for another job during a pandemic, she applied for zillions of jobs until she finally found one. They offered her a job with no sick time up front, none, no vacation time for a year. No, put that in perspective, no vacation time, no sick time for a year in a pandemic, and she had to take a substantial pay raise to take the job. And this is a large employer that has national chains across the country. She chose to take the job because she's a hard worker and she wants to work. And during a pandemic, she took whatever she could get. But I remember having a really hard conversation with her about what that would look like for her. And if she could afford to stay, she has a young son who has a number of challenges. So she can't take time off even to go to a doctor's appointment. And, you know, realistically, what I said to her is you do what you need to do. And in the interim, you do your darndest to look for something else. Because there is no way that they believe that you're going to stay taking a substantial pay cut. And the only way they could get her closer to her previous salary was by adding massive amounts of overtime. So I guess my thought is this. And I'm curious your take on this, Representative Olson. I know that she's a hard worker. She is exactly the kind of worker we're talking about here. She's an executive assistant. She works her tail off, has a young child, and we know a lot of women in that case. And I'm curious if we know of any anecdotal studies or information or background on how this is impacting other women in the workforce. Because I'm, you know, when women are making up 50% of the workforce and we're already driving them out for other reasons, I guess I have real concerns that not caring for this population could have really strong ramifications down the road by not implementing something to care for these workers, especially in the midst of a pandemic. Could you speak to that, Representative Olson?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner. I think that story illustrates exactly what we're trying to do to make sure everybody has this benefit like your friend. So as I mentioned in the opening, that about 30% or 36% of working people, so that's 932,000 Minnesotans, don't have paid sick and safe time. But when you break down who those people are, it's women, it's people of color, it's low-wage workers. That's true in our state. That's true in other places. So we are talking about, to your point, exactly the kind of people that need it the most and are most impacted by COVID-19. As we know, those who were laid off from jobs were predominantly women. service industry workers, you know, had really tough times. And that's exactly who we're trying to reach and what this bill is about. So when we drill down on who those, that 36% of working people are in our state, we're talking about a lot of what you just mentioned, Representative Bonner.
Representative Bonner, follow up or shaking her head no. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you're the last person on my list, so I'm going to give you a little more leeway.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
You got a little bit of time here, but I want to get to at 5 minutes at 9:55. I want to get to a vote on this. So
understood. Thank you, Nash. I'll wrap my comments around that 5 minutes. So, Representative Olson, if you would, tell me what is the difference between the definition of family or family member in your bill versus some of the other implementations in other parts of the state? If I'm not wrong, I believe that yours is a bit more expansive.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. Yeah, I don't have the language of the exact language of the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth ordinance, but yes, it is a definition based on some of what we had in those ordinances plus more. So, yes.
Representative Nash.
So, Representative Olson, in the crafting of your bill, obviously you've made a conscious decision to expand what a family member is. Maybe give me or give us and folks watching some ideas to what those new designations or assignations are for what is a family member.
Representative Olson.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, let me just get that page on the bill so I can just read the definition here for you. So page 2, article 1, section 2, a family member, an employee, a child, foster care, adult child, legal ward or child of the employee, spouse or registered domestic partner, sibling, step-sibling, foster sibling, parent or step-parent, grandchild, foster grandchild or step-grandchild, grandparent or step-grandparent, any family member listed in the clause as a spouse of the registered domestic partner, individual related by blood or affinity with those close association with the employee, and up to one individual annually designated person by the employee. And this is, so I guess the city that would most closely, I think it's pretty identical to St. Paul's. So there's already a city that has implemented it, and a lot of this was in the Duluth and Minneapolis, but it is more closely tied to St. Paul's from what I understand.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, it's a very, very, very broad list. And I again, Representative Olson, you and I know each other pretty well, and I do appreciate your compassion here. But this is a hugely expansive list of people that could be the triggering mechanism to have somebody come home to take care of them. And I appreciate your compassion, but here's my problem with the bill. I drive up and down the main streets of the different cities that I represent, and I look at all of them, and they're all small business owners that live on exceptionally tight margins, and they have been getting punched in the face over this pandemic. And we keep hearing, oh, we're all in this together, we're one Minnesota, we have your back, we're with you, whatever. And to the small business owners and all business owners, this doesn't exactly say that from where I sit, Representative Olson. This says, we're glad you're still open and alive, whether it's on life support or whether as a business. We're gonna give you another round just to see how resilient you are. Because this is going to be outrageously expensive. This is going to cost business owners, and I think you know, and maybe a few others do. I call myself a recovering business owner, having sold my business not long ago. And I'm glad to be in recovery. Good Lord, would this be awful? But the cost to the business owner is going to be staggering. And these are people that we live next door to. These are people who live on your street, that you go to church with, that you see at the soccer pitch or whatever. And
this is going to be an incredibly onerous piece of legislation that would put millions of dollars on top of business owners around the state. And Representative Olson, I'm going to follow up with you offline because I didn't get a very good answer as to what does this do to a farmer? What does this do to people who are already living on tight margins in their business? Because this is, as the school board said early on, this is an unfunded mandate. This is going to add so much cost to both public and private entities. So, I again, Mr. Chair, I will say I appreciate the latitude you have afforded our members. I am grateful for that, but recommend a resounding no vote on this because it is unbelievably expensive to our business community. And as Representative Olson has applied a fairly liberal approach to what is a business, it covers pretty much anybody who is in Minnesota. And it seemed to be a very one-size-fits-all situation. So I thank you for the time, Mr. Chair. I'll be voting no.
And members, it's 9:55. I want to get to a vote on this. Representative Olson, if you want to do a quick wrap-up, and then we'll get to a vote. Representative Olson.
Sorry, probably good to unmute here. I apologize. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the discussion today and ask for your support of House File 7, because no matter where you live, your job, or the color of your skin, through our differences, we want many of the same things. We want to snuggle our kiddos to make them feel better when they're sick. We want to see the doctor before an illness goes from bad to worse. We want to be able to recover from the flu without worrying about missing bills or losing a job. House File 7 is about moving towards the kind of caring state we all want Minnesota to be, one that reflects the compassion Minnesotans have for our family, friends, and neighbors. And I ask for your support of House File 7. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 7 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And the Committee of Legislative Aid will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne? Representative Cleburne?
Cleburne votes aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, no.
Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
So that the motion has prevailed, the bill's on to the Committee on Judiciary Finance. And members, we were going to here, we'll be back tonight at 5 p.m. I'm going to be in two committees at the time, so the evening meeting is going to be chaired by Representative Carlson, Vice Chair Carlson. So with that, members, we are in recess till 5 o'clock.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'd like to reconvene the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Again, we are reconvening from this morning. We have one bill on the calendar remaining for today, House File 1200, Paid Family and Medical Leave. Representative Richardson is here with us today. I'll move Representative Richardson's bill before the committee. I do see that we have an author's amendment, the A21. Representative Richardson, if you would like to describe the amendment, or if you prefer, I see we have Ms. Marta James also available, if you would prefer her to summarize the amendment. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Ms. James could summarize the amendment, that would be perfect. Thank you.
Great. Ms. James, to the A21 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a technical amendment. It adds several cross-references to the bill, and then it also adds definitions and clarifying language to specify which account the bill is referring to. So just makes a couple technical changes.
Okay. Any questions on the A21 amendment? Give everybody a second here. I'm not seeing any hands. Any questions on the A21 amendment? All those in favor of the A21 amendment, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. Okay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We do have the bill before us now. Representative Richardson, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1200 would create a paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program administered by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The program is modeled after our state unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families in order to be able to take time for critical bonding with new children, and would also allow workers access to comprehensive leave to care for themselves or a family member. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for many Minnesotans is it's not that simple. In the midst of the COVID pandemic, it has become even more clear that illness can strike at any time, and for workers without paid leave benefits, individuals are too often left with the impossible choice of choosing between caring for themselves, a loved one, or a paycheck. COVID has shone a spotlight on our society's inequities and also highlighted the strength of paid family and medical leave programs. Paid family leave is a bipartisan issue, and other states have implemented programs that provide important lessons learned. The first policy was passed in 2002, and with subsequent states adopting paid family and medical leave policies, there's a roadmap that helped to shape this bill. In fact, our bill takes a number of elements from the Washington State Paid Family Medical Leave Bill that passed with bipartisan support in July of 2017. Washington State began to pay out benefits in January 2020, confronted with the full force of the COVID pandemic. They processed more applications than expected, but the fund remained solvent, and payroll premiums will remain flat for 2021. Paid family and medical leave done well is a considerable contributor to statewide efforts to promote equitable growth. Today, I have a number of testifiers on behalf of this bill, and the chair, I would request that you recognize Deborah Fitzpatrick to provide a quick walkthrough of the relevant portions of for the committee.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Deb Fitzpatrick was the first testifier.
Hi. Good evening, Chair Carlson, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I have a few slides that I'd like to share for this walkthrough, so I'm going to share my screen. Wanted to just highlight that I am here today as the Director of Policy at Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, but I'm presenting also from my past role at the University of Minnesota Humphrey School of Public Affairs, where I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated design and implementation study for the state. I wanted to take just a few minutes, can't move the slides here. Wanted to take just a few minutes to kind of go over the structure of the program at a high level and can take some detailed questions later. House File 1200 is structured as a contributory social insurance program. This is the dominant and successful model in 8 U.S. states and most countries around the world. So what does that mean? It means that most employers and workers contribute to a state fund based on their wages. For an average median worker in Minnesota earning $52,000 a year, that would be about $3 that's contributed on behalf of the employer and the employee. The few exceptions are employers that offer comparable benefits, and those employers can provide their own benefit program, and self-employed workers who are eligible to join the program if they choose. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and on their earnings, plus the need for an eligible leave. And finally, healthcare providers certify that need for leave, and then workers make a claim on the state fund, and that state fund then is providing that support to the workers while they're on leave. As Representative Richardson already mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes to reduce the employer burdens, as well as to help ensure a successful build out of a new state program. So I'm gonna apologize. Okay. Sorry about this. I got some technical challenges here. I'm going to just open it. This is a PowerPoint instead. I apologize for the technical challenges. All right. Apologies. It's still not advancing. So. Slideshow.
You're stuck on slide one, huh?
I am. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, if you can walk us through them.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry. All right. So the program, I'm just going to kind of do at a high level the benefits structure so that the committee is aware of that. Up to 12 weeks per year for a worker's own serious health condition and up to 12 weeks per year for the care of a family member. It's important to note the data from the U.S. Department of Labor and many other state programs, as Representative Richardson mentioned, have a track record over time that shows us that most workers often use fewer weeks than the maximum allowed, and the vast majority of workers use the program for only one leave over multiple years. Now I wanted to turn for a moment to the pieces of the bill that are relevant to this committee's jurisdiction. The first is the state as an employer, wanted to call attention to Section 6, where the definitions for covered employment, the employer and employee are laid out. Lines are mentioned here. The state of Minnesota would be an employer and most of its workforce employees under these definitions. So as an employer, the state would be treated as any other employer contributing to the trust fund on behalf of itself and its workers and providing notice and leave with employment protections to workers eligible for benefits under the program. State workers would then, as we've talked about already, receive the wage replacement from the state fund during their leave. Now, the state could also, like any other employer, alternatively choose to substitute a comparable private plan or their own plan, and under that circumstance would no longer contribute to the state fund. It would make other arrangements to provide benefits equal to or better than those available through the state program. I wanted to speak for just a minute about the elements of the bill that address collective bargaining. Those are included on page 62.21. Basically, the benefit program is viewed as a floor for future collective bargaining agreements. Nothing in the bill limits the parties in a collective bargaining agreement from bargaining for other elements, but the bill, the benefits that are laid out in this bill would be the floor. Just briefly wanted to touch on some of the appropriations that also are in the jurisdiction of this committee. And as there are members of the MMB staff online as well to answer additional questions later, but those begin at line 67.22. It's important to note that the appropriations in the bill assume that the state as an employer is participating in the state program as opposed to offering its own program. So just touch on a couple here, but wanted to call out the largest ongoing general fund implication or appropriation is for the premiums for state workers. So again, as mentioned earlier, employers and employees split the premium. This appropriation starting on line 67.22 is for the 1.9 million and then moving on to 3.7 after the first year of premium collections is for those premiums for state workers. There's also a small appropriation for the Legislative Coordinating Commission. MMB might be able to answer more questions about this. My understanding is that most of the legislature would be covered under the costs to upgrade the system that were in the previous slide for MMB, but there's the House, is outside of that system. So there's a small need for funding to cover those expenses. And then finally, just wanted to call out that, of course, this bill does create a new deed division and a trust fund. The Family and Medical Benefit Insurance Division, you know, that isn't created in deed is there to administer and operate the program. And finally, the account is created as a special revenue fund in the state treasury. This fund, then the premiums are deposited in this fund, and those funds are then used to pay benefits under and to administer the program. I think it's important to note that the program is designed to be self-funded so that after the initial year of state funding that is in the bill, all of the costs associated with the program, other than those premiums, again, for the state workers would be covered under the premiums that are collected and would come from the trust fund. And also the bill does have those funds that are in fiscal year 22 being paid back by the trust fund in subsequent years once revenue is being collected. So with that, I'll stop and just also somebody from D, Darielle Dannon, is here as well to answer questions or share details on appropriations, startup, and program administration within the deed appropriations of the bill. So I'll stop there and apologize again for all the time.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Very much appreciated. The slides were helpful. Representative Nash, I see you have your hand up. We have multiple testifiers.
I just wanted to be first on the list, Mr. Chair.
All right. That's what I like to hear. Okay. Next, Representative Richardson, I have a Kimberly Lewis next. Is that next on your list?
Yes.
Wonderful. Ms. Lewis, if you could please proceed with your testimony or introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Lewis. I am with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent all 333 school boards across Minnesota. And tonight as well, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. We appreciate the opportunity to share some initial thoughts on House File 1200. We have not had the opportunity to meet directly with Chair Richardson, but we hope to do that soon. And we look forward to learning more about this bill as it moves through. Our board's administration, and particularly our school district business officials and human resource representatives, have some questions and concerns as it relates to the implementation and management of the proposal. As with last year's House File 5, our school district business officials and HR reps have alerted us to three main concerns or questions that I'd like to share with you this evening. Our primary concern is the cost to school districts. School boards do not have the authority to levy for the funds that would be needed to cover the employee portion of this proposal. In addition, when employees are out, districts must hire a sub. That's another cost, a direct cost to the outcome of the bill. Since we don't produce a project such as widgets or what have you, we can't increase our price per se. So the funds would need to come out of the general fund, in other words, the classrooms. There is a soft cost also to the administration and reporting of the program at a district level. And at a time when most schools in Minnesota are experiencing budget deficits and making cuts, especially in the midst of this pandemic, we are concerned about how we would pay for this. Another question is how it would relate to collective bargaining and how that would be impacted, if you will. If passed, would this statewide benefit be a part of the local bargaining negotiations? And I think I heard the previous testifier mention that briefly. Or would it supersede the negotiations or both? And then how would this align with currently negotiated paid time off in our collective bargaining agreements? For instance, our teachers' collective bargaining agreement is, we're right in the middle of that right now. So the July 1st implementation date could be problematic or something to be considered at this point. And finally, due to the nature of the workforce that we have within our school districts, there would be a potential for a greater need for the number of substitutes. Employees could potentially be out of the classroom for up to 24 weeks of the school year, or longer if they were to also use their accrued sick and vacation time in addition to this leave. If that were the case, our HR reps who struggle now to hire subs wonder how would an adequate number of highly qualified substitute teachers be available and other support professionals to be secured when they are already in such short supply. It's our responsibility to keep continuity in the classroom and with a highly qualified teacher or other personnel in front of our students at all times. We plan to continue discussions and with both our district personnel and Representative Richardson, we look forward to that and we appreciate the committee's time this evening and listening to our concerns. And with that, I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn-Lewis. I appreciate your testimony today. Next, in terms of testifiers, I have Jessica Peterson-White is next on my list.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Jessica Peterson-White. I own Content Bookstore, and I serve on the Northfield City Council, and I'm also a member of the Main Street Alliance. When my son Thorsten was born in 2016, I budgeted at my shop to have about a month at home, and then I eased back into work. And it was expensive to cover all of my hours. So I spent a lot of days and nights with a baby and a laptop in my arms or with the little guy napping behind the counter. Lyra, my third child, was born early last March, and while I planned carefully so that I could be home with her for 10 weeks, it didn't work out that way. Because of the pandemic, my maternity leave lasted a little more than a week, and then I was working harder than ever before to make sure my bookstore survived 2020. Self-employment has given me flexibility, but I've made painful trade-offs between investing in my business and caring for my babies. In 2018, the city of Northfield passed a six-week paid leave policy for our employees. That's paid family leave and paid medical leave. We heard many stories of similarly terrible choices for our city employees we're facing, and all of these stories represent costs, existing costs, often in replacing staff, but also in morale when people are forced to choose between what's best for their families and their jobs. We're proud of our policy at the city, but it's not enough, and unpredictability is our biggest constraint. It's hard to budget because our pool is small. It just makes sense to ask employers and employees to contribute to a statewide fund, which would benefit everyone when they need it and protect us all from big variations in costs. Statewide paid leave insurance would also mean that Content and the City of Northfield could compete with larger employers by offering comparable benefits. And it would ensure that when one of my 12 employees has a new child or an illness or a sick loved one, they could care for their families and return ready to work while my business had the resources to cover their responsibilities. It would make my business stronger and more resilient. I don't think anyone believes babies should go to daycare 2 or 6 weeks after they're born, or that it's humane to force a new mom back to work at that point either. But if we're not choosing to provide a system that keeps family income steady during those precious early months, we're pretending that that is realistic, or we're pretending that working parents can afford to skip a few paychecks. Every single city employee, every Content Bookstore employee has a family counting on them to be a caregiver at least sometimes and to be breadwinners too. Nobody should have to choose between the well-being of their child and their job. Please support a paid family leave system. Support House Bill 1200 to ensure that all families get a healthy and secure start. Thank you.
Th- Thank you, Ms. Peterson-White. Appreciate your testimony. Next on the testifier list, I have Angela Byrne. Is Angela on the call? Angela, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, sir. Good evening, members. My name is Angela Byrne, and I'm a proud state employee and MAPE member from Roseville. In February 2016, at age 31, with a 16-month-old toddler, I was thrust into the sandwich generation in the worst way. My mother, Robin, was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer and a sepsis infection that nearly killed her. I had little paid accrued leave after my maternity leave, so I applied for FMLA and moved in with mom. After I returned to work from FMLA, the responsibilities continued throughout 2016 and 2017 with seemingly endless follow-ups, tests, medications, plus repeat hospitalizations. And that doesn't count all of the time fighting with multiple insurances and Social Security Disability Determination Services. The nightmare ultimately ended after my third FMLA and a second round of treatment that left her weak enough to succumb to pneumonia on February 11th, 2018. She was 57. To add to the cruelty of the situation, after my bereavement, I was out of FMLA and accrued time, paid time off to handle her final arrangements. I took leave as I accrued it, but almost all of the time I spent caring for mom and then her estate for those 3 years was unpaid. The stress of caretaking and her death left my mental health in shambles. I have been in and out of work since, again, with mostly unpaid leave. I have not received a full annual salary since 2013. In addition to my lost wages, I have sacrificed a non-trivial amount of my retirement. My husband and I are extraordinarily fortunate that we could weather this storm without completely destroying our long-term financial health. However, I am painfully aware that this isn't true for so many families. My mom was one of those people. She went back to work just 2 weeks after giving birth to me because she would be fired if she took more time off than that. I sit before you tonight, almost 2 years to the day since I last spoke to this body on paid family and medical leave, in the same month as the third anniversary of my mom's death. 35 years after she returned to work, still broken and bleeding from childbirth. I ask you, how much longer do we have to wait for this program? Thank you very much for your time tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Byrne, for sharing your story. I agree. There's unfortunately a lot of families that can definitely relate. So thank you for being with us today. Next, for testifiers, I have Justin Aurelius. Is Justin on the call? And Justin, if you can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, members. Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Aurelius, and my wife and I both work for the state of Minnesota Community-Based Services. She would have liked to have been here tonight, but she was unable to attend due to she is working. I'm currently working, so I'm stepped off the floor right now. I live in Granite Falls, Minnesota, and I help community members with disabilities to live more independent lives. I'm a member of AFSCME Local 701. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1200, paid family medical leave. I think every worker should be afforded the time to care for their loved ones in a time of need. This is about our society recognizing the value of that care. When my wife and I had our first child, I was one of the workers that did not have much paid leave, unfortunately. My wife, Amanda, had a C-section, and I had to go back to work within just 10 short days. She was alone with our baby adjusting to a brand new life at home and recovering from a major operation for several weeks. And for me, leaving our family each day was really hard to do. I was located an hour and a half away from home. It was emotionally really difficult because I wanted to be by my family's side. It was hard for me. I can imagine it was even harder for her. Also, it was a financial challenge too. And at one point, we actually had to move in with my mom due to everything that had happened. Luckily, when we had our second child, we both had access to paid parental leave. It was a benefit our union helped negotiate for state employees. At the time, I recall feeling like we were lucky that we had won the lottery. It allowed us both to live a life that we weren't afforded with our first child. But why does it have to be that way? Why should new parents feel like lottery winners? for spending time with a newborn baby. Shouldn't that be an expectation of new parents? Our society should put a higher value on caring for loved ones. We should have a system where people don't have to choose between a paycheck and caring for their family. I believe in personal responsibility, and I believe in working hard. I also believe that when we pull together and care for one another, we're more connected and we're stronger and healthier for that. My last thoughts are, working parents need paid family leave, personally, because it just put us in a situation financially where we could just feel free, and it just helped us out. So hope you guys can recognize that, and I appreciate your time. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you, Mr. Aurelius. We appreciate your time as well. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next testifier, I have Kate Davenport. Kate, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Davenport. I'm one of the co-presidents of Eureka Recycling based here in Minneapolis. We're an enterprise with approximately 150 employees and also a member of Main Street Alliance. Like other small businesses, the last year of the pandemic has been challenging. We've operated at full capacity the whole time as we provide a vital service of recycling collection and sorting to communities throughout the state. Of the 120 of us, less than 10 are able to work from home full time. The rest of our team have positions that require them to be on the front line, driving trucks, fixing equipment, and sorting recycling. We were really grateful that Congress provided small businesses the ability to provide paid family and medical leave as part of the Families First Act for COVID relief adopted last spring. It helped us to meet our responsibility to our employees and to the public health by providing tax credits to businesses that could continue to pay employees when they were sick with COVID, had to quarantine or care for their children. We've always provided paid time off and paid sick time for our staff, and it's been a key benefit to the culture and resiliency of our organization. However, the pandemic revealed that there are times when employees needed more paid time off than we provided. The coverage of COVID-related sick time and paid time off was vital in preventing a widespread infection throughout the staff and keeping us operating. No one should have to choose between staying healthy and getting their paycheck, especially during this global pandemic, which has revealed that. The largest challenges with the program, the FFCRA, has been that it limits each employee to 80 hours of medical leave, and that it's only for COVID-related absences. We decided to cover any time over the 80 hours for COVID-related issues outside of our normal PTO structure to ensure that staff felt supported and that they stayed home. This was a worthwhile investment of tens of thousands of dollars, but is not something that most small businesses could afford to do. This past year showed us that something like paid family medical leave, which you're considering, would actually allow our staff to access these kind of benefits at a lower cost than what we have taken on ourselves over this last year. Establishing a paid family and medical leave system through the state is really what will help the small business community. It helps level the playing field for small businesses in attracting and retaining employees, as larger employees can often provide the benefit of extended paid leave that small businesses can't. Again, the cost to a small business to pay into paid leave, like you're considering, is less than covering this cost ourselves and helps us retain talent and skills. So I really encourage you to support this program. I think it's a really vital investment, so please support it.
Thank you, Ms. Davenport. Appreciate your testimony today. Thank you for being with us. The last testifier on the list is Ms. Amy Eggert. Amy, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, good evening. My name is Amy Eggert, and thank you very much for having me here tonight to speak. I speak on behalf of Isaiah. I'm a college professor at Southern New Hampshire University, and I teach business courses. I believe paid family and medical leave is essential for Minnesota families. When I was pregnant with my first child, I applied for short-term disability through my employer. And because of my pre-existing condition, I was denied. My challenges were many: migraines, bed rest, a premature baby with jaundice, postpartum depression, an infection the first week after delivery, and a major surgery 6 weeks after delivery. I was fortunate to have support systems that other families did not have, a loving family that supported us. Therefore, I was able to take the full 12 weeks to care for and bond with my baby, recover, and go back to work for my employer. Yes, I did have my mother help me with the house so I could be the best mom to an infant that I could be with the challenges I had. Now, some people say that is what new moms should do, rely on family and friends. But what about mothers that do not have a safety net of family and friends? As the Family Medical Leave Act coordinator at my workplace for a company with several thousand employees, I was always stunned to talk to mothers who couldn't afford to take time off for medical leave after having a child. Usually these were single moms, and they didn't have a choice. Oftentimes, when people have infants or children and they have to work and they don't know what's going on with their children, they're not really at work 100%. You know what I mean? So paid family and medical leave makes it possible for moms and dads in Minnesota across race, class, and geography to not worry about where their next meal is coming from and how to pay the bills. They can go to work and they're at work. So they can lovingly bond with their newborns. It also levels the playing field for small businesses with the large corporations that already offer this benefit. Paid family and medical leave will help get the newest Minnesotans off in a stronger, safer, and healthier direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Eggert. Appreciate you sharing your story with us today. That's it. That's all we have for testifiers today. So we can move to member discussion. Members, I will state that we do have several staff representatives, administrative staff. We have House Research available to answer questions. We also have representatives from DEED as well as from MMB. So based on your question, if you want to state who you would like to direct your question to, if it's other than the bill author, please do clarify that. So first on my list, I have Representative Nash. Representative Nash, please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first couple questions will be for the author herself. Representative Richardson, you had stated, and I just wanted to get this one out there, that this is a bipartisan issue. You said that a couple of times. In looking at your authors list, both in the House and then the companion in the Senate, there are no Republican authors. So what did you mean by saying that this was a bipartisan issue?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I was referring to the fact that there have been bipartisan bills passed in other states. And when we look at the research that has been done most recently after the COVID pandemic in terms of who supports paid family leave, there is bipartisan support for that as well.
Okay, but not here. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, but just not here in the state of Minnesota or on your bill.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, as I stated, the reference to bipartisan was related to bipartisan bills that have passed within other states.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, question also. When this bill came before us in a previous biennium, there was a conversation, fairly lengthy conversation, relative to the software that would be required to track all these things. Can you walk us through what that software is and how it's going to be put together and if you could just walk us through that, I would be grateful to that, because I do have a couple questions relative to that.
Representative Richardson, otherwise I know if you want to kind of get started on that, we have others that can assist as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will just state in terms of the previous bill that was carried, there were a number of others who helped to support around the IT questions. I know Representative Elkins, we're working together on this as well, and would be happy to have Representative Elkins or the department talk through.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Richardson, the question it comes back to, it was previously going to be utilizing the UI software. Is that still the direction that you're pursuing with your bill?
Representative Nash, I see Representative Elkins shaking his head in wanting to respond, so I'm going to see if he can
provide some further context. I did have a question. It is directed to the author, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Slow down. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, yes, the format would be built upon the unemployment insurance format.
Okay, and Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, to that point, it was previously established both at the admission of the previous author, Representative Halverson, from the past biennium, and then by minute, that the UI software is not one that is just going to be able to be used in its current incarnation and would require a fairly substantial amount of work to get it to do what it is that you're asking for it to do in this bill. Is that still the understanding that you have of your bill?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, there will need to be changes to the system, as you mentioned. I will also just add that in terms of looking at the recent changes that the department had to go to related to the pandemic unemployment insurance is another example of, you know, having to be able to be responsive as we have had to be with the COVID pandemic. And in terms of lessons learned, I think that there are a lot of lessons that have been learned from the state of Washington, which this bill has a number of elements that are also based on that bill out of Washington.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, Representative Richardson, if you remember, the software that was hopefully being used for the state of Washington wasn't really quite working. And you know, some members on this committee are members, you know, Representative Bonner is a member with me on the Blue Ribbon Commission that the governor set up for IT. And it was decided in the report that was published that software was going to be something that was not a bespoke piece of software or a handmade, tailored or edited, that it was going to be something that was purchased, not made. So it's the buy versus build mentality. And what you're trying to get done here with at least the software component of this is going to be quite extensive and expensive. And goes against the recommendations of a bipartisan commission to not go down the road of a bespoke software situation. So, and Mr. Chair, I will come back and ask for somebody to address the fiscal costs of that. But my next question is, Representative Richardson,
Representative Nash, we've allowed some back and forth here. This is the last one? Because we'd like to get to some other members.
I have plenty of questions, but I'll make one more question, and then we can come back, and I can ask a dozen or so more. But this will be my next question, and then I'll take a breath, and we'll come back to some other questions. But
very good,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Richardson, help me understand what is the periodicity? What is the length of time that the premiums are going to have to be collected before they could even begin to get paid out? Because as I remember it from previous incarnations of this bill, it's a very long period of time before the taxes are collected until they could actually begin getting paid out to people. So could you walk us through that, help us understand what is happening with your bill that's perhaps different than the last incarnation?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair. And just one quick comment before answering that question as well. In terms of what we are trying to do here is to really ensure that families are not put into the position of having to choose between a paycheck and caring for a loved one. So, I mean, ultimately, that's at the heart of this. So the way that this bill is crafted, again, it looks similar to the way that the state of Washington organized their program. So after the start, there would be a year and a half delay of collecting premiums before we would begin to look at paying out benefits. The idea is to really focus on creating a solvent plan. So that would result in a delay before premiums would be collected. And I think that the learnings of what we saw within the state of Washington, that delay was really important because when the Washington plan went into effect, it happens to be right in January 2020, and they were faced right away with the COVID pandemic. But even with being faced with the pandemic and being faced with increased use of the program as a result of the pandemic, that's a situation that because they spent some time building up the solvency of the fund, that they're going to be able to keep their premium rates flat for 2021.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just real quick.
Quick follow-up, Representative Nash. We do need to get to some other members. We'll put you back at the bottom of the list,
Chair,
I promise.
I do understand. So you're going to have a year and a half of collection before you're solvent. Is the software creation editing going to be longer or shorter than that period of time? And then I'll be done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Representative Nash, in terms of looking at the software pieces, there are conversations that are happening right now with the departments around timing. But again, in terms of what the lessons that we have been able to learn from other states, what is currently within the bill now reflects what happened in Washington, and they were able to complete that that project on time.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Next I have on my list is Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know we have Daryl Dannon from Deed is on the call. And so I think it would be good to have her address the project timelines for the project in terms of the general approach. I would first of all say that, since we last heard this bill 2 years ago, DEED has had a major upgrade of the current unemployment insurance system. And as a result of those upgrades, the DEED Minute team feels comfortable that they can take a clone of that system, basically, because under federal law, you can't commingle UI with anything else. But the current UI system is suitable to be cloned and then modified to run this program on it. Modifications are reasonable. This is an approach to development that I have taken myself in my career as a solution architect. I know that the team has already reached out to the Deloitte team that built the Washington system from scratch. This is not going to be built from scratch. We're taking an existing software platform and modifying it to adapt it from unemployment insurance to paid family medical leave. We'll have Ms. Dannon discuss this in more detail, but I have met with them. And I feel comfortable with the approach that they've laid out. They're doing their homework. They have reached out to the Deloitte team that built the Washington system from scratch. So they've been able to take lessons learned from that Washington team. And I'll let Ms. Dannon continue. But I, at this point, I feel comfortable that they should be able to complete this project on time and within the budget that they've laid out. So Ms. Dannon, if you can address that, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Ms. Dannon, I believe you're on the call. If you want to speak more to that, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Representative. So, hi, my name is Darielle Dannon. I'm the Government Relations Director at DEED. I'm happy to chat about some of the build out and some of the IT work that we've done here. Let's see. You know, it might even be, well, I'll give a little basic overview and then happy to answer questions. I will just say that, you know, of course, we all know, I think that our friends at Minute will obviously be very involved in this process as well. So I'm not going to hold myself out to be an IT expert by any means. I think actually Representative Elkins is being modest, and he probably understands more about IT and the IT build on this than I do, but happy to chat about it a little bit. We did have our team go out to Washington State, as I think the chief author of this bill referenced, and meet with the team there. And our IT team at Minute has also reached out to both Washington State and a number of other states to get a sense of really that build time, and also to get a better sense of, I think, you know, as Representative Nash was pointing out, some of the recommendations from the Blue Ribbon Council about not building everything from scratch, but instead potentially using components that other states are utilizing, or, of course, as folks here have referenced, utilizing some of the components from our existing unemployment insurance system as well. So obviously that's a very high-level summary there, but certainly that's the trajectory that folks are thinking about here of kind of heading into this work. We do have the work budgeted out over actually a somewhat significant amount of time. We would start bringing staff on in fiscal year 22 and staff that up more significantly over fiscal years 23 and 24, and then start reducing our staffing components sort of in those other years. And of course, as one would with any IT system, we would expect that we would have some IT staff dedicated to this process and this program kind of over the long term. So I think I'm happy to answer questions. Maybe that's enough overview for now, and then I can pause, and I'll be here for the duration. So happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dannon. We appreciate you being with us today.
Brian
Downey, Elkins, did you have a follow-up question?
Just real quick, the Chief Business Technology Officer for DEED at Minute, Brian Alley, has been involved in the discussions that I've been involved in as well. And he would second what Darielle just told us if he were here today. I was hoping he would be here today, but I don't see him on the call.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Next, I have Representative Claiborne. You're next on my list. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions. I can ask one and then a follow-up and then come back to the next if you want. Just let me know how you want me to proceed. The first question I have tonight is, I heard Ms. Davenport mention in her testimony tonight that she was relying on FMLA, and I'm just wondering if you could please discuss the difference between paid family medical leave and FMLA. And Representative Richardson, I would ask you to determine who might be best on your team to answer these questions. This question, thank you.
Representative Richardson, do you have a testifier? Or would you like to speak to it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will begin and turn it over to Ms. Fitzpatrick. But, you know, in terms of thinking about family medical leave, that is not necessarily a paid, that's not a paid leave. And so that is one of the biggest differences between the programs. And Ms. Fitzpatrick, I don't know if there's additional information that you would like to add.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Yes, I think besides the paid element, there are a few different kinds of leave that we are addressing in this particular bill, safety leave being the major one. And then the other piece I would say is that about 55% of workers are currently covered under the FMLA protections, and our bill would cover many more workers as part of this program.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I ask my second question then?
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Claiborne.
All right, thank you, because I think these differences are really important, especially given the constraints that FMLA has and then this policy as well. when I was listening to Ms. Byrne discuss the very painful issues that she experienced, and I'm very sorry to hear about the death of your mother. I know how difficult that is. She made me think about what our families are going through today. We are both in a global pandemic, and we are in an economic downturn. And we have many, many Minnesotans who are sick, and then we have many of those who cannot take time off. How will this policy really help our families deal with this situation that we're facing today? I think it's a very critical question that needs to be answered. Thank you. So,
Representative Claiborne, were you directing a question towards a particular testifier or back to the bill author?
I would always say to the bill author, and then she can decide who which she would like to best address.
Very good. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne. I think that you raise a really important question, especially as it relates to equity, because I think what we have to talk about right now is who has access to paid leave and who doesn't. And so when you begin to, you know, to look across the data, we definitely see disparities in terms of access, be that racial disparities or gender disparities as well. And right now, within the context of the COVID pandemic, two of the demographics that have been hit the hardest within our state are women workers and also Black workers in Minnesota when we look at the data. And so being able to have access to paid family leave and having, you know, what amounts to, in essence, a universal program for Minnesota workers is really, I think, an important step to beginning to address like the deepened disparities that we see as a result of the COVID pandemic and an economic downturn as well. And I don't know if Ms. Fitzpatrick has more that she'd like to add related to that question.
Ms. Fitzpatrick?
No, I think you did a great job.
All right. Okay. Thank you all. Next on my list, I have Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing your bill. Congratulations, Representative Richardson. You brought a very progressive bill. It's been said that progressivism is a front door to communism, and I think this
has... Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please proceed.
Do I have the floor, Mr. Chair?
Please proceed, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill certainly accomplishes that. It takes over a large share of the private sector and business and has government take that away from them. And not only the decisions, but in this case, what appears to be billions of dollars of money as well. I'm curious, Mr. Chair, and the author, Representative Richardson, is there a fiscal note for this bill? I looked through the notes. I didn't see it. I'm wondering how big. I'm trying to remember from 2 years ago, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, how big is the slush fund that is built up over the first year or two of accumulation with this bill?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski for your question as well. I think that it is really clear within the context of the pandemic that we are in, there are lots of people who have needed help, be it through the payroll protection programs or be it through paid leave. And this is really about ensuring that families have access to be able to not be forced to choose between, you know, having a paycheck and being able to care for themselves or a loved one. You are correct. There is the fiscal note is still being prepared at this time, and so that will be coming within the future. Within section within Article 3 of the bill, it does lay out a number of the appropriations that are pretty similar to the last bill as well. Within looking at fiscal year 2020. There's an initial investment that would be paid in. The thought process would be that those funds would be returned to the general fund once the program is solvent. And as Ms. Fitzpatrick talked through as well, there are several appropriations that would relate back to the actual premiums that would need to be paid. And I think it's also important to note that within this bill, there is nothing that requires that a business would be would have to pay in to this particular fund. They could choose and elect to have their own paid family medical leave program.
Representative Drazkowski, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you. I've got several questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. So do we know how much money this bill is going to extract from private sector employers and employees for the first 2 years and stack into a slush fund largely unspent on benefits during that time? I do remember the bill from the floor discussion last time, and that was very clear to me both in Ways and Means and on the floor last time, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. Do we know how much that is?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, in terms of what that would look like, it would depend on the number of businesses that would opt in to participating within the program. Again, they would have the option to opt in or to provide a comparable program. When we're looking at what those premiums would look like, as Ms. Fitzpatrick laid out earlier, if you're looking at someone with a salary of about $50,000 a year, that could translate into a premium of $6. Three of that could be attributed to an employee, and the other three to an employer.
So, Mr. Chair, and
yes,
and Representative Richardson, I mean, so you don't know, we don't know, no one knows how much money this bill is going to extract from workers and employers over the next 2 years before anything is even spent on benefits. I do remember a figure in my head. I don't even want to guess if it's correct. So I would ask, Mr. Chair, what is the plans for this bill? Is this going to be laid over until we can actually see a fiscal note for the bill, this being the Finance Committee?
Representative Drazkowski, no, I plan to take a vote on this bill at 6:25, which is in about 25 minutes from now, and we will be referring this bill to the Commerce Department.
So Mr. Chair, we're going to forward the bill, the major finance committee that is tasked with reviewing the financial components of this bill, and we're going to pass this bill without even knowing the financial impact of the bill. Not a good decision, Mr. Chair, not the way I would suspect you really want to run the House. But I have two other questions for the author, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski, if it's along these same lines, please proceed. But I do have other members that would like to ask questions as well. So if they're related to the subject matter, please continue with your line of questioning.
Yes, it's, I ran into a dead end and we didn't get any answers about the huge fiscal impact that this is going to create. But I'm curious about some specifics, Representative Richardson, on page 9 of the bill. It defines employer, and there's definition of all employers in here. Two questions related to that. It lists government entity. I don't know what that means. And then secondly, it seems to be missing schools from there. Is there a reason schools is not specifically stated? Oh, I'm sorry. Statewide system was the one I didn't understand on line 9.27. But then school seems to be missing from a definitional employer. I think that was your intent, and that was I know that was in the bill last time in the discussion of some opposition to the bill earlier. So I'm curious about those, and then I have one question.
Okay, hold on there. Let's let Representative Richardson address that one first. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I would ask Deb Fitzpatrick. She talked a little bit about the definitions of employee yep. and employer.
Sounds good. Ms. Fitzpatrick, could you speak to the question?
Yes, and I could also refer to counsel who helped with this. We are picking up this definition of employer or employee from Washington State, again, to kind of be able to take advantage of the systems that they've developed there. I do believe that the intention was to include schools, and you're looking at line 9. Sorry.
Line. What was that, Draskowski?
Page 9, generally, line 9.23 through 10.2.
Yes, so I believe that the that was the intention. Maybe we could ask council to take a look at that and see if there was some piece of this that we missed in the drafting.
Do we know what stateside system means?
Okay, hold on, slow down.
Statewide system.
Let's please ask our questions to the chair. We have one question before us right now. If you want to refer that to House Research for an answer, we can do so.
We could do that, but I imagine that might be something like the MinSKU system or something of that nature.
So Mr. Chair.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. It sounds like most of the bill, if not all of it, came from Washington State, and we don't know what the definitions even are. I think, Mr. Chair, this bill, the author and the people supporting her don't even know the content of the bill and what they mean or why things are missing. So I find that to be problematic as we think about moving this bill to the next committee. But, Mr. Chair, my next and last question was on line 17.3 and through 17.5, and I would ask the author, why are we exempting payments that were made to largely musicians, radio, television, similar artists in production of television commercials, musical jingles, radio spot transcripts, and spot announcements? Why are they exempted from the collection of taxes under this particular bill?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Draskowski, for your question as well. And, you know, as mentioned before, the language is really based on some lessons that have been learned from Washington and other states that have gone before us within doing this work, and that is another example of language that we have pulled from the Washington piece. And with the decision to take some of the lessons learned from other states, it's really been around looking at building a program that is going to be sustainable.
Thank you, Representative Richardson.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm done, Mr. Chair, but we have a bill before us that came from Washington State. It looks like it's been simply put into the reviser's machine and then spit out before committee here. We don't have a fiscal note. We don't know what it's going to cost. We don't know what many of the elements of the bill are. Mr. Chair, the thing to do with this bill is to lay it over. Otherwise, we're not acting responsibly as the Finance Committee. It's supposed to really look through this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. Members, we have about 20 minutes left before we move to a vote. We have numerous members that would still like to ask some questions. So if we can be succinct with our line of questioning and allow ourselves each just one follow-up question, that would all be appreciated so everybody can get their questions answered. Next, I have Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask, I have a quick bit of a clarification question from Representative Draskowski's questions that I'd like to ask before I get into my question Representative Richardson, I really appreciate you bringing this bill. And I have heard, I think, from Representative Nash and others, the amount of work that's gone into it over the years and this year. And so I think sort of the characterization, it being new to this place, the characterization that it was both deep in and lots of people were in it and also just exported from Washington State feels inconsistent. But from what I, just a few questions, this works a lot like the way that unemployment insurance works, the fund and everything. Is that right?
Representative Richardson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, that is correct, Representative Freeman. It is built upon the UI work and also many of the definitions are related to the state of Minnesota definitions as well, correct.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I think about unemployment benefits, I don't think about communism and a slush fund. So I just wanted to make sure that we're sort of thinking about the right model. But I actually did not come to this committee meeting expecting to tell a story, but I really appreciate and want to lift up the stories because I think probably most people have one. And as I was thinking about this bill, when I was 29, my dad was facing multiple myeloma, which was a very aggressive cancer. My dad was in Mayo for a long time, and my sister was a nurse at that time, an RN. And I remember the moment of sitting at a Perkins in Rochester and having Annie ask the question, so I have this much PTO left, I have this much, and then I can take this much FMLA. I was in law school, so I was out of state, and we were trying to figure out how to be there for my dad, who was dying. And having to have that conversation, and I can't imagine what it's like for families in all of these different ways to be able to make those tough choices. And when I was talking to my sister, because I just wanted to make sure that she remembered that conversation too, I sort of asked, what did you end up doing? What did we do? And she took the time, she maxed out all of her PTO, she took FMLA, and I asked how it affected her budget because she was 26 and a new nurse. And she said my dad helped her pay for some of it. And I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that help. And I don't know what people can do when they don't to make that choice. And so from that sort of what I want to ask you, Representative Richardson, is, you know, from my sister's story and the questions she had for me coming into this hearing are we know that that access to this isn't distributed equally. And so I'm interested in the families that don't have that support, who has access now, and how would this impact what we have heard from all of these committees, which is the disparities in our workforce and in our and jobs, and particularly thinking about both income and racial disparities. I'd love to hear what your thoughts on that.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Freeman, for your question. And, you know, what some of the data tells us, even looking at particularly like with low income workers, if we look at the Department of Labor data, it says that most people or 25% of folks are going back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. You know, so that gives you sort of a spotlight for many low-income workers in terms of being able to have not only sufficient time for child bonding, but also for sufficient time after giving birth to be able to recover. You know, we heard from a testifier today that talked about his wife having a C-section, and think about having to return back to work within 2 weeks after a major surgery like that. When we think through where we tend to see disparities in terms of access, it is definitely going to be among some of the lowest income workers within Minnesota. And there is also going to be disparities in terms of gender for women, and also racial disparities in terms of who has access. So a huge component of this bill is about equity, and it's about ensuring that there's equitable access. And the disparities that we see today really build on a legacy of disparities that we have seen not only in Minnesota, but within the state as well, because if we take some time to even track the history of our Social Security program, for example, you look at the history of like who was left out of Social Security in the very beginning, 60% of Black workers, because there were decisions made to exclude farmers and also to exclude domestics. So the disparities that we see today are pretty similar as well in terms of as we think of who would have access to this type of leave.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. And members, again, just a reminder, we've got about 15 more minutes for questions. I've got four or five members. I want to allow Representative Nash a chance to be the closer in terms of questions, but also want to allow adequate time for Representative Richardson to make some closing comments. So, Representative Bonner, if you could please be succinct with your questions, that would be appreciated.
I will do my best. I have first a couple quick comments and a question. The first, I just wanted to say thank you to the bill author for bringing this forward, and I really appreciate that we do have that period in the beginning to build up those funds so that they're self-sustaining. I think that's the financially responsible thing to do. And I really appreciate that attention to detail for the budget. Second, everyone here knows I'm a big process improvement person, always have been. And I really appreciate the fact that we've done a lot of work over the years in terms of working through the discovery of that feedback loop, the lessons learned from various states around the nation, including Washington among them, to really get a sense of what that would look like, especially when it comes to our IT systems. And of course, yes, we do have some Blue Ribbon Council members on this committee. And certainly I hope and would like to believe that myself, Representative Elkins, and even Representative Nash would love to be a part of the conversation in helping shape and guide the future of what that could look like and making the best possible decisions for that. But here's my question. So we know that caring for elderly parents is extremely expensive. Assisted living, nursing home care, that kind of thing. When my 85-year-old grandmother, who by the way ran the entire flight kitchen at Northwest Airlines, started to have some real challenges. Our family had to come down to a decision on how we were going to do that, right? And grandma really didn't want to go into care. And my mother's solution ultimately was to leave the workforce. And I know a lot of other women and families who are in this position. But I'm wondering if we have this coverage so that people can take time out to maybe deal with some of those issues rather than the assisted living or the nursing home care. I'm curious about the differential in what that might look like rather than going to really expensive home or expensive care, having people be able to instead use this program to help care for those loved ones. If someone might be able to speak to that.
Okay. Representative Richardson, there are a couple of questions in there. You kind of snuck those in there, Representative Bonner, but we'll let it slide this time. Representative Richardson, you want to speak to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner. I think, you know, what you're really getting at is one of the primary reasons that paid family leave can be so helpful in retaining the workforce. And I think that is not only thinking about it from the perspective of caring for elderly parents, but also thinking about it from the perspective of bonding with a new child as well. Because, you know, what the research tells us is when people have the opportunity to take paid family or medical leave, that tends to have them be able to stay within the workforce longer as well. And I don't know if Ms. Fitzpatrick would have anything to add on to that.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, a quick response?
Sure, really quickly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is definitely a very robust research base that shows that these types of programs do reduce the need for nursing homes. that they do reduce preterm births and a whole host of other health outcomes that do actually save families money, but also the state money in the long run. So it is an investment that not only helps people, but could also help the bottom line of the state.
Thank you. All right, members, again, just to kind of recap, I still have five members that would like to ask questions. If it hasn't been asked yet, we can continue on, but I definitely want to allow for Representative Nash to be the closer in terms of questioning and allow for Representative Richardson to make some final remarks. Next on my list, Representative Mason, you could please be succinct with your question.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to change what I was going to say. I did have a question, but I just want to say when I ran for public office, it was because I thought I could help people. That to me is my priority, is to do the best I can to help our people. And I'm hearing some comments today that I find incredibly offensive and certainly not sharing that priority. It's more about money. And the thought is, and we've heard some stories about people who've had children and did not have somebody to help them. I mean, I cannot tell you how vulnerable somebody has to be in a position like that and not have somebody understand that it is a problem that we have the ability to solve. And the other thing I'm going to throw in, I remember some friends of mine had gone over to one of the Scandinavian countries, and they said it is remarkable how much happier their younger people are. I mean, we have burdened our families with so much. And for our legislators, all of our legislators, not to understand that to me is beyond comprehension. So if the author wants to again say exactly how this will help people that normally are without help, without support, that might be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I can feel your passion for this bill. Representative Richardson, a quick response to Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mason, for your question as well. And that's, at the heart of this, that's what this bill is about. It's about supporting families. It's about helping families. And within what the research shows us is that, states that have paid family leave bills, the benefits don't just flow to the families as well. They flow to the state and to employers as well. And so with what we know on the research and what we are seeing on the reports, employers are able to retain more employees. Families are able to care for their families better, and present employees help to, they're the backbone of our businesses, both small and large.
Thank you. Representative Quam, it's your lucky day. I'm bumping you up on the list. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I share the intent that's been spoken about. But being a person that worries about implementation, having experienced all the issues that we've had with updating, software, not having the budget numbers, and then having a lot of, we're not sure because we're trying to borrow it from another state where underlying laws may be present there and not here. I am just concerned if we're going to do something, we need to have it done right, prepared, and I don't think we're quite there yet. And so I would move to table this bill and would ask for a roll.
Representative Quam asks for a roll call on tabling the bill. Do we want to take that now?
Or do Mr. Chair, that's why I waited to raise my hand.
Okay. Very good. Let's take the roll on tabling the bill. Would Ms. Spreck please take the roll?
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Greenman? Representative Greenman?
She's on mute.
You're muted. I'll come back to you. Representative Cleburne?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative New Brindley?
Yes.
Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, no.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Greenman?
No.
With a vote of 8 nays and 5 ayes, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Ms. Breck. Next on my list, I have Representative Cleburne. You've got a minute and a half, if you could please be succinct. And then Representative Nash, you're on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure, earlier this morning when we were discussing the other bill, I talked about the false choice between either funding our schools or supporting legislation. And I want to say that that is a false choice in this conversation as well. Funding our schools is an entirely separate conversation to funding paid family medical leave. And the question that I have that I would like to bring to Representative Richardson is this. While we do not have the fiscal note, and I understand that that is an important piece of our work, we will, in fact, have an opportunity as legislators to vote one more time where we will have that fiscal note available to us. Is that correct?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. Like other legislation, it will move through the committee process. We have other committee stops before we get to the floor.
Representative Cleburne.
I'm concise, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Representative Nash, closing comments?
Yeah, no questions, but comments. To the last comment about it's okay if we move this out of committee, even though we don't have the fiscal note. No, it's not. This is a finance committee where we are talking about important things that the state is going to have to pay for. And to say that it's okay to move a bill on before we even understand what the totality of the cost is reckless and irresponsible. I want to point out a couple of things. Please, for anybody who was watching earlier and may have left in the middle, this is not bipartisan, even though Representative Richardson would have you believe that it's a bipartisan effort. It's not. You heard from the school boards tonight, and there's a letter from the League of Minnesota Cities talking about the fact that there are giant looming questions over this. Both the school board and the cities will tell you that this is effectively an unfunded mandate. Unfunded mandates that get pressed down to lower units of government get paid for through general fund appropriations, which means that they come out of a levy. As a former mayor, I will tell you that is the only way they get paid. So by passing this bill, you are saying it's okay to raise taxes on people who live in cities that all of us represent. Also reckless. And I want to be concise and finish here to say, Representative Richardson and those of you that are supporting this, I would challenge you to pull out your Chamber of Commerce directory for your local area and walk up and down Main Street, wherever you might happen to live, knock on the door, talk to the business owner, and share the fiscal note, share the implications, share the costs, share everything that's going to go into this. Look them in the eye and ask them, is this something that you are in support of? Because they're all trying to take care of their employees, but this is a humongous cost that small businesses are going to have to absorb. This is a humongous cost that is going to go really into the wallets of all of those people who are struggling to stay afloat. This is going to go to school boards and city councils. I would ask you to set up meetings with them too and say, do you have the ability to pass another levy to pay for this? Because my guess is if you look at the history of levies for schools, it's not always easy to get that done. And I'm just going to say again, the fact that we don't have a fiscal note and that we're passing this out of committee is I'm just gobsmacked. This is not a good process. You should have the fiscal note so that we can talk about concrete numbers in this committee of jurisdiction. I would encourage your no vote for that reason alone, that you are about to cast your vote and say, I'm okay with effectively writing an open-ended check. It's just fine. I'm not okay with that, and I would urge your no vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that we are tight on time here, so I will strive to be concise as well. You know, what we are really talking about here is a matter of equity. It's a matter of ensuring that families are not being, again, placed in those really difficult decisions. And what we have learned from the COVID pandemic is that there are lots of pieces that work together to ensure that our economy works. When schools were closed and when daycares were closed, that had a huge impact. And so being able to ensure that families have access to paid family medical leave, again, has benefits not only for the family being able to care for themselves and for their loved ones, but it also impacts the costs that we know occur within the state as well. Because when families don't have a safety net, where those costs are born, they're born in our communities, they're born in our counties, and they're born on our state. In terms of thinking through what happens when someone can't go back to work because they are ill, or they can't go back to work because they're caring for a child. Those are all things that are going to have bottom line impacts on our systems, and they're going to stress our systems as well. And so this is about ensuring that we're providing a safety net for families, just the same way that we provided a safety net for businesses faced with the COVID pandemic, the billions of dollars that went out for payroll protection loans. Those are things that we did in order to ensure that our businesses survive, and families deserve the same type of support to ensure that they're able to care for their families and themselves as well. And I would ask for support, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson, and thank you to your testifiers, and all the testifiers that were here today, taking time to be with us in this later hour. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 1200 as amended to the Commerce Committee. If the committee legislative assistant would please take the roll.
Is Chair Carlson?
Yes.
Chair Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
No.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, no.
Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Ms. Breck. Members, before we adjourn, our next meeting is on Thursday, March 4th, 8:30. We've got a couple bills set on the agenda, so I'll look forward to seeing you all then. And with that, members, we are adjourned.